Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org.
So, Phil, what I hear you saying here is that what you're referring to as mantras in the more colloquial sense, these oft-repeated phrases, that we find these phrases within Mormonism. You discovered them by leaving regular sacrament meeting attendance for 17 years and then coming back into it, hearing these oft-repeated phrases and realizing how they really had they do perform the function of mantras in LDS culture to the extent that they are mind tools. They shape our minds, they shape our discourse, they shape our culture. And you point out that you raise the question of whether the mantras that we have within LDS culture, within Mormonism, are the best ones that we could have. And there's a quote here from your essay that I liked. It says, I've heard it said that we Latter-day Saints left the sacred grove many years ago and have been trapped in a beehive ever since. Our common LDS mantras and the culture they create support external compliance and organizational activity to such a degree that even influential general authorities working hard to promote genuine spiritual growth have minimal impact. Could you elaborate on that statement?
Well, I find it interesting that, I mean, Mormonism started with a mystical experience of communion with God in a sacred grove. And, you know, we've evolved into a culture now where people are afraid to pray too long. I still have people, when I encourage in Sunday school class, when I encourage people to pray long enough to get outside of their mantra prayers, you know, their repetitive phrases, to stretch their souls, invariably I'll have somebody raise their hand and make reference to Elder McConkie's talk given during that George Pace episode, where he discouraged lengthy prayer. And, you know, so we have people that are afraid to even pray beyond kind of their repetitive needs and desires or prayer patterns to where they can even get to a state of communion with Spirit. I gave two examples in the article where I saw Elder Packer and Elder Oaks in particular in areas in which I lived. Do things to get people outside of focus on just organizational stuff and to root themselves more deeply in genuine spiritual practices and perspectives, only to have those overturned just by the organizational culture. And so in many ways, we've established a culture that focuses on external worthiness, external religious practice, and we're just not encouraged, much less instructed, in how to do the inner spiritual work that leads to rebirth, that leads to transformation, that leads to the unfolding of a Christ-like nature, where we can put aside the negative habits that disrupt our lives and gunk up our relationships, and have the ability to acquire the Christ-like natures that are desired. It's the inner work that makes that possible, and we're just not doing much of it.
Well, you used the example of a beehive, and that has been a symbol of Mormonism for a long time. We've got the carvings of the beehive on many of our buildings in Salt Lake City. And that idea of the our, you know, and when if you look at our LDS meeting houses on Sundays, they certainly do seem like a beehive of activity. They're very far from being a very serene atmosphere of calm and reflection that you might find in a Buddhist monastery, or so I'd imagine. And so it seems like what you're saying is we're missing this element, this appreciation for stillness, for silence, for reverence, and instead we've become wrapped up in becoming as of pursuing spirituality by becoming as busy as we possibly can with as many activities and programs as possible.
Yeah, I mean, most Mormons validate their spiritual worth by their level of church activity. I mean, in a casual conversation among Mormons, just mention casually that you spend 30 minutes or an hour meditating every morning.
And they'll think you're a Fruit Loop.
And then just watch the stairs. I mean, what validates I mean, just look at the phrase active Mormon. Are you active in the church? Oh, he's inactive. That's where our obsession is inactivity. And although, you know, there is a system called karma yoga where spiritual transformation results as a way of providing selfless service, where one serves beyond ego out of pure awareness in the present moment and out of pure love for another person, that can be spiritually transforming. But that's typically not what's happening in most of the activity that we're talking about. So I'm back to my premise now that the inner work needs to be done, and we just don't provide encouragement, instruction, validation for people doing this deep spiritual inner work.
And maybe we can then address the question that again, that I'm sure you've asked yourself numerous times, which is why? Why, for example, if I could, you know, play the role of, well, maybe I can play the role of myself 10 years ago and say to you, you know, Phil, this is great that you personally have found or feel you found some sort of insight and through meditation, and I'm really glad that you were able to overcome your physical pain. But I start to feel really uncomfortable when you start to suggest that because you found something really special and great in meditation, that demonstrates that there's some sort of deficiency within Mormonism. I mean, if meditation were needed, if it were a great and wonderful thing, I would expect it to be even mentioned in General Conference or in an Ensign article or in a church news article or in any of the numerous manuals that we have in curriculum. And so, you know, perhaps I would have said to you 10 years ago, that's great, Phil, what you're saying about meditation, but I'll start meditating when President Monson or his successor tells me that it's something that I need to do as part of my true spiritual practice. I mean, what's your response to that?
Well, it's a great question. You know, in the article, I have these quotes by President McKay, where he defines spirituality as the consciousness of victory over self and of communion with the infinite. And that doesn't sound like a Mormon phrase because of the word consciousness and communion and the word infinite. What he did personally, I don't know. I mean, people have said, I don't believe he was meditating the way you teach, and he probably wasn't. But I do believe it is an inspired statement. You know, consciousness of victory over self is this overcoming of sleep. It's this overcoming of conditioned, limited awareness. And that results from communion with God, of communion with the infinite. There's that other statement where he said, in our worship, there are two elements. One is the spiritual communion arising from our own meditation. The other is instruction from others. Of the two, the more profitable is the meditation. And then in this beautiful statement, he says, meditation is one of the most secret, most sacred doors through which we pass into the presence of the Lord.
Now, again, that's a quote from President McKay.
It is.
Okay.
And the way I typically answer this is, you know, he mentions this word secret. Well, you know, it's typical in our Sunday school rhetoric to advise people to avoid the mysteries and to stick with the basics. It's completely contrary to the scriptures. Throughout the Book of Mormon, throughout the Doctrine and Covenants, we are encouraged to seek the mysteries, to move beyond the preparatory gospel and to have the mysteries revealed to you. Well, the truth is the church can't be responsible for the revealing of mysteries. That is an individual by individual part of the spiritual quest. That's only something that can happen between you and God himself. So the church really can't be responsible for revealing the mysteries. The church is really responsible for establishing the gospel, as the Book of Mormon defines it, which are the foundational teachings. It's really an individual responsibility to pursue the mysteries. And what are the mysteries? The mysteries are a clear, aware, experiential knowledge and awareness of the nature and presence of God, the nature of my own soul, and the relationship that I should be having with God. I mean, those are the ultimate mysteries. And that is an individual responsibility, not a church responsibility.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't think there's anyone who would disagree with that at all, that that the responsibility rests on our own shoulders to achieve those things. I guess the lingering question is, although it's true that the church can't provide those things for us or just hand them to us, couldn't it at least, and couldn't the leaders at least point out the method or the means to get there? And I guess that's my point, which is, if meditation is a valid means of getting there, and from, you know, based on your life experience, I think it's fair to say that you think it's a pretty essential way to get there. Why is Nephi not telling us, you know, about meditation posture and focusing on our breathing? And, you know, why does, you know, the prophet Isaiah never mention it? And, you know, none of the gospel writers write directly about it. I mean, I'm sure that you've pondered these questions before, and I'm just wondering how you personally answer them.
Well, I mean, ultimately, I've moved in the direction where I have felt led by the Spirit and what has worked for me. At first, I spent a lot of time trying to correlate all of this with church teaching. At some point, I just moved on in the flow of grace. You know, and I'm not trying to equate myself here with Jesus, but, you know, the thing that the religious leaders were amazed about with Jesus is that he taught as one having authority and not as the scribes. Well, how did the scribes teach? Well, the scribes taught from the books. You know, they were their experts in what these scriptures taught and that scripture taught, and Jesus wasn't limited to that. He wasn't bound by that. His teaching was a manifestation of his relationship, his intimate relationship and communion with God. That's what he taught out of. Aware of the scriptures, yes. Could he teach from the scriptures? Yes. But he clearly was teaching things beyond the scriptures or beyond their understandings of the scriptures, because of his enlightened awareness. And that's just the direction I have gotten to move. Now, my wife would say that as a people in general, we're obviously not prepared or ready for that. And so, you know, we get kind of what we're prepared for as a community. And for those who are ready, then the Spirit opens up those potentials and possibilities.
Sure. So another way of looking at it would be perhaps milk before meat, and perhaps meditation is for those who are ready for the meat. But the sort of default institutional assumption arguably needs to be that providing milk, at least for the time being, is what's most important. And because I would think a lot of people would say, well, Phil, if I'm going to meditate, you know, if the brethren think I need to meditate, then obviously the brethren are going to provide that opportunity. And I have that in sacrament meeting, and I have that in the celestial room. I mean, if I'm supposed to really meditate and commune with God and achieve this higher consciousness, isn't that what the celestial room at the temple is for?
Well, it could be, it should be. I don't see a lot of that when I go. And the truth is, you know, most of the men that are general authorities because they've demonstrated loyalty to the organization and success in administering the functions of the church. And frankly, most of them have very little knowledge or understanding of meditation as we've described it. So they're not teaching it because they're not aware of it. And again, so then it becomes a, you know, an individual responsibility. I gave a presentation at Sunstone last August called Hindering the Saints. And it was based on that scripture where Jesus was criticizing the religious leaders of the day for being hypocrites, which I do not believe LDS church leaders are. Number two, for not understanding the inner or deeper meaning of the scriptures, and for setting up a system of worthiness and external worship that hindered people who were ready to enter the kingdom of God. Well, I do think there is a problem with those latter two things. I'm not sure a lot of the brethren do understand the inner meaning of the scriptures. The processes that need to take place for spiritual transformation to unfold. I do think people are restricted and hindered because we have set up a system of external worthiness and external religious practice that diverts people's attention away from inner spiritual development. Jesus was critical of those things in his day, and I to some degree believe we have those same problems today.
Let's talk about, circle back to a topic you brought up earlier, which is the issue of certainty versus uncertainty. And I guess I'm wondering, let me just kind of think out loud here. I guess I'm wondering whether one of the reasons that members of the church aren't encouraged, you know, over the pulpit and general conference to engage in Eastern-style meditative practice might be a couple of things. One being that it's an extremely individualistic experience, meditation, and that it seems as though the church leaders would like us to channel our spiritual practice through church activities and programs, that it keeps us tethered to the, I think what they see as the stabilizing, safe, secure course. And that if someone goes off into meditation trying to explore higher levels of consciousness, that they might be let off the straight and narrow path. And I guess what I'm saying is there a tension between Eastern meditative practice, and I shouldn't keep saying Eastern because, as you pointed out, you know, the Christian Orthodox Church has a rich meditative tradition. Even within the Roman Catholic Church, there's a meditative tradition. But is meditation, is this individual spiritual pursuit at odds with or in tension with organized, structured, institutionalized religion? Can they coexist? Can they be integrated together? Or do the brethren not mention meditation because they see some sort of danger there?
Yeah, an excellent question. There is a natural internal tension there. And there is an element of risk. Maybe the best way to explain this is I'm actually writing about this currently and should have an article out soon on this topic. I've done this in public in a number of places, but I've developed.
Where will it be published?
Well, assuming they like it, it should be in a it should be in a future Sunstone.
Okay.
And then I'm actually working on a book, and it'll be in that also. But
okay.
I've developed a model of stages of spiritual growth based on scriptural images. And in the model, it starts with the parent-child stage, where authority is the main function here. And when you have whether it's a young child growing up or an immature spiritual person learning to develop in spiritual growth, there needs to be someone in authority who is kind, who is nurturing, who has the interest of the person at heart and can lead him and guide him. It's a parent-child kind of relationship. And the focus is on the knowledge and experience and authority of the leader. At some point, you know, leaders shouldn't be bound up holding hands for the rest of someone's life. And the natural evolution is to move from the parent-child stage to the steward stage, where you've learned certain commandments and rules and procedures, and now you demonstrate your stewardship by being productive, by being responsible, by producing, so to speak, in the church context. And you acquit yourself as a good steward with those things that you've been taught. But at some point, if a steward is wanting to progress, you know, they look at the master and they say, gee, rather than just being a servant to the master, I'd like to be like the master. And at that point, there's a natural evolution into what I would call the disciple stage, where a person's intent now is to actually become like Christ or become like the master. And the discipleship stage is a transitional stage. And typically what will happen, and this is where there's risk, the disciple is, I mean, once a person through their inner spiritual work begins to know the master and become like him, there is a natural shift of loyalty away from the organization to the master himself. And that's the shift that can be dangerous or risky. The church has a whole ton of history of people who believe they've evolved themselves spiritually to the point where they don't need to function in the church anymore. And in many cases, people become self-deceived and they rationalize all sorts of aberrant behavior because of the revelations they're receiving. And so it does become very risky and very dangerous. The parent, child, and disciple stages tend to be safe. They tend to be predictable. They tend not to cause problems. And so organizationally, there is a tendency to keep people in those parent, child, and steward stages. So the discipleship stage is transitional, And typically what happens within Mormonism is those who are experienced and bright and spiritually developed who will often tend to then channel their discipleship aspirations and their spiritual development and talent back into the organization to nurture folks at those earlier stages and to express their loyalty to the organization. And so their discipleship gets diverted back into those first two stages. It's very helpful to the people at those lower stages, but the discipleship movement stagnates at that point. For me, ideally what should happen is the loyalty should shift from the organization to the master. And once that loyalty is there, then the person becomes unpredictable. I mean, when I was asked on my mission to do things that I believed were unethical, other missionaries did those things. The result was internal conflict, all kinds of suffering, bitterness, anger. They ended up going inactive. I didn't do it because I was spiritually advanced. I just couldn't do something that was obviously absurd. And it kind of saved me from a lot of the problems those missionaries had. But at this point, if I had to make a choice between something I believed was in harmony with the nature of Christ that was contrary to being to something I was being asked to do in the church, I'm going to choose the master, not the organization. And that's where things get risky. And again, you can understand the organizational tendency for predictability and control. Now, the stages beyond disciple is the friend stage and the beloved stage. And these are stages where you enter into a friendship with the master. And if you think about what a friendship is where there's mutual sharing, mutual understanding. It's hard for many members of the church to believe that they have something that they could offer at some level of equality with the master. And so there's a tendency for people to not even believe that's possible, and they never move into that friendship stage, much less this stage of intimate oneness of the beloved stage. One of the strangest things about Mormonism is more than any other Christian religion that I'm aware of, we teach eternal progression. We teach the possibility of literally becoming like God. We talk about divine nature in a more real way than in most other Christian religions, but most of our members don't feel that. Most LDS counselors will tell you that 90% of the women that come to see them feel deficient, they feel inadequate, and I sit back shaking my head trying to figure out how is it that Mormons who were taught that they are literally children of God, that they have divine nature within their soul, can feel inadequate and deficient. I mean, it is the strangest thing. That inadequacy and deficiency can only come from the way we're practicing our religion. It can only come from the way we do Mormonism. And it obviously is undoing this flow of progression toward becoming a friend of the Lord. So what could I offer Jesus on a level of equality of friendship? What you can offer is the sharing of an awakened soul. If in fact there is spiritual rebirth and spiritual transformation and the divine nature within you has unfolded and is becoming like him, then it's obvious there is going to be mutual interest and mutual sharing and mutual understanding. And that potential is at the core of Mormon teaching and doctrine. But because Latter-day Saints aren't doing that inner spiritual work and aren't having that inner spiritual development taking place, they're not sensing this. They're not really experientially experientially experiencing. They're not actually experiencing the true nature of their essence of being, that unlimited divine potential. And because church culture pushes downward for stability and predictability, people stay stuck in this parent-child or steward mode that we like so much. And so you miss the joy of this friendship. You miss the joy of becoming the beloved of the Lord.
So, Phil, now is probably a good time to segue to a discussion of your other article published in Sunstone Magazine called The Yoga of Christ, Letting Go of Our Attachments and Becoming United with God. Actually, Phil, I should back up. Did I add that as my own subtitle, or is that the subtitle of your article?
Yeah, there was no subtitle. It was just the,
okay.
It was just
the So I'm reading my, I'm rewriting your article here in my outline. Okay, let me read you the question. This was reminding me the general topic that we were going to be discussing here. So sorry about that. Let me do it. Let me do a do-over. Okay. So Phil, let's turn to a discussion of your other article that was published in Sunstone Magazine entitled Yoga of Christ. And one of the questions that you pose in that essay is, you ask, have we so westernized or Mormonized Christ's teachings to the point that we've lost critical perspectives and insights? Is it possible that the teachings of Jesus are so comprehensive that they encompass the core spiritual principles of both East and West? And so why don't I let you use that as a jumping off point to discuss your essay, The Yoga of Christ.
Well, sure. I mentioned this a little earlier when I went through this crisis of, am I a Mormon guy or a yogi guy? And And the resolution for me was this experience I had with that passage in Matthew 11, come unto me. And I actually spent several months interviewing people in the church that I admired and respected, bishops, stake presidents, in one case, a general authority. Some BYU professors, people that to me exemplified the best that we have in Mormonism. And in our discussions, sooner or later, we would be talking about just general life challenges and struggles and difficulties with family or work or health and so forth. And all of the folks that I talked with ultimately talked about the burdens of mortal life. And of course, Jesus says that if you take his yoke upon you, the burden will be light and there will be rest. And not one of these individuals reported to me light burden or rest in the Lord as a general tenor of their life. And the conclusion I came to is, if we're not experiencing the light burden, then we're obviously not practicing the yoga of Christ. You know, we're not being yoked with Christ, as it explains in Matthew 11 there. And during that time period, I was studying deeply the writings of Paramahansa Yogananda, who came to America with the message that he actually came to America with a message of restored yoga, which I thought was interesting. He was explaining how the yoga tradition had gone into apostasy and how his particular lineage of gurus had restored the true essence of yoga teaching. And part of his message was to share with Christians in America that the original teachings of yoga and the original teachings of Christ were in harmony. And of course, that's, I explained earlier, is what I experienced when I began to understand the teachings of Jesus in a much deeper and richer way. And well, as I was studying the writings of Yogananda and other yogic scriptures, and I began to see this harmony with the with the teachings of Jesus. What dawned on me was this. In some core yogic scriptures like the Bhagavad Gita and the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, there was a simple twofold formula that seemed to be at the center of spiritual rebirth or spiritual transformation. And those two things were communion with God and a principle that's taught very commonly in Eastern traditions of detachment or non-attachment. And it is taught that the interplay of these two things, being able to detach yourself from the things of the world and the function of conceptual thought and desires and fears, and to be able to detach from that and to root yourself in communion with your inner being and with the presence of God, that union with God ultimately takes place, and of course spiritual rebirth. What dawned on me was that Jesus, I believe, exemplified and taught very clearly the importance of those two principles. And I call it the yoga of Christ now, because I believe in his teachings and his life and the symbols of his life and the events of his lives. He taught those two principles as clearly, if not more clearly, than anything I was finding in ancient yogic scriptures. And of course, in the article, I go through many, many scriptures where Jesus talks about not being attached to the things of the world. And
why don't you, give us a few or several examples, if you will.
Well, just going through the New Testament, you know, if anyone wants to take away your coat, let them have your cloak also. Don't lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. One's life does not consist in the abundance of things he possesses. So he's obviously talking about not being attached to our possessions, our earthly treasures, our riches, or as he says, anything that can be stolen or eaten up by a moth. He says in Matthew 6, don't worry about your life, what you eat, what you drink, your clothing. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. He's clearly telling us not to be attached to our bodies themselves, nor to any sins to which the body might be inclined. He tells us not to resist an evil person, but if someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn the left cheek. Take heed that you don't do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. He talks a lot about the problem of people doing things to be seen by men. They love the best seats at feasts and the best seats in synagogues, and of course encourages the greatest to be the servant. So he's clearly telling us not to be attached to image, to pride, to reputation, to position, to power. There's that great phrase in Matthew 6 where he says, don't worry about tomorrow. So he's telling us not to be attached to the future. He has that great verse, no one having put his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God. He obviously doesn't want us to be attached to the past. Of course, many of the psychiatric or psychological problems that people have are these deep attachments to burdens and pains and disappointments in the past. Scriptures about if your brother sins against you, you know, go to him and try to work this out between the two of you. He even says if you bring your gift to the altar and you've got something against your brother, reconcile that before you bring your gift to God. And then he talks about the significance of forgiveness. If you don't forgive others, your heavenly Father won't forgive you. So
don't be attached to your grudges. Let go of your grudges.
Sure. Don't be attached to anger, to resentments, to offenses that that you've received. And of course, we all receive those. But if you become attached to them, you can see it ties your mind up in the past. It gets you thinking about the future and ways to protect yourself, and it takes you away from the present moment, which is where spiritual life is.
And again, a lot of these negative qualities you're talking about, like anger or pride or jealousy, are rooted in our attachment to reputation, attachment to a particular self-image that we feel is offended or attacked, that we then feel like we need to defend through angry or negative or sometimes even violent behavior. Is that the idea?
Well, yeah, because again, we're identified with our image of ourselves, our thoughts, our emotions, our feelings, and our identity is posited in that and not in our essential nature. And so when those things are threatened, we act out that distress and try to protect ourselves.
It really helps you understand the expression poor in spirit. I remember being a teenager reading that in a Sunday school class and thinking it was such an odd way to phrase a virtue. We just usually do not associate poverty or being poor as being a good thing, a positive thing, a virtuous thing. And so I could never figure out being poor in spirit, but it seems like that sort of phrase is another example maybe of what you're talking about, that through this process of letting go of our ego, our self-image, our reputation, our expectations for a specific outcome in the future, the more things we let go of, the more impoverished we become. But it's a good poverty. It's a poverty that consists of lacking any sorts of attachments. Is that the idea?
Yeah, I mean, this is a classic Zen Buddhism sort of story that, you know, if your cup is full of desire, of fear, of attachments to people, places, things, situations, outcomes, and circumstances. I mean, if your cup is full of all of those things, then there's no space to be able to receive spiritual nourishment or to receive the blessing that comes from communion with God. And so the idea is to empty all of these things out so that there's space to receive divine presence. And we tend to be attached to all sorts of things other than that. And so what amazed me as I began to do this study in the New Testament was how often, how extensively Jesus taught this principle of non-attachment that is difficult to explain, that doesn't sound very desirable, because we normally associate the word attachment to things that are good and positive. The fact is our attachments to things limit our ability to receive grace for grace. And again, it was just one example to me of how clearly the teachings of Jesus were in harmony with what I would call yogic philosophy.
And so in your article, you basically summarize how you see the yoga of Christ consisting of two main elements, the first being non-attachment, and then how that arriving at a state of non-attachment, of letting go of all these things we've discussed, then puts us in a position to truly commune with God. And maybe you can tell us about that second aspect of the yoga of Christ.
Yeah. See, this isn't a linear kind of thing. These two things revolve at the same time. So just to be able to meditate and to commune with God, you have to practice a certain level of non-attachment. I mean, the fact that you're going to take the time to sit in a room alone and detach your awareness from your body and your thoughts and your activities to be able to meditate. See, those are the beginnings of non-attachment. As you begin to root yourself in divine communion and your identity begins to shift to your inner soul nature, then the need to be attached to things outside of yourself that give you a sense of security or power is lessened. And it's easier then to let go of the things that support the image of yourself or to support the things that make you feel safe or secure or powerful in the world. You can start to let those things go. And to the extent that you can let those things go, you see you're creating more space for communion and the influence of the Spirit. So this kind of works hand in hand together as we seek for spiritual transformation.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, and then that famous, you know, Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. So to the degree that we root our identity, our sense of identity and being in God, the natural consequence of that is going to be less desiring, less wanting, less needing of things that are external.
And as an example, Jesus was homeless and unemployed from what I can tell from the scriptures. And I guess the ultimate expression of non-attachment is ultimately not even being attached to his own life. I'm intrigued by this quote in your article. You say, here's a quote, "We are so verbal today that it's hard for us not to imagine prayer either as monologue, in which I tell God things and God listens, or as a conversation in which I tell God things and God answers back. But from what I can, understand out of the ancient monastic materials I work on, prayer is really an entire relationship, and the verbal part is only one element. A lot of what we learn when we pray is to be quiet. We need to stop thinking that a relationship is constituted only by language. The issue is not so much does God talk back, and if so, how, but whether we can learn to just be in God's presence." I was wondering if you'd expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, we are very verbal, obviously, because our thoughts are in words. And in yogic philosophy, it is the activity of the mind that overshadows or covers soul nature. And so we're back to this, be still and know that I am God. We've got to get beyond the activity of the mind. And of course, as we said before, most people's prayers are mental activity. And their prayers tend to be extensions of their ego, and they tend to be ways of getting what you want and avoiding what you don't want. None of that is spiritually transformative.
Can you explain just a little more specifically about what it means to say that our prayers are extensions of our ego?
Well, if you look at the things that people pray about, what do they pray about? They pray about their attachments. They pray about, and I'm not saying they're bad things necessarily, but they're praying for things that give them their sense of identity, of well-being, of safety, of security. They're the things, the people, the situations, the outcomes that we're attached to feel like our lives are meaningful or successful. Those are the things that people normally pray about. And they're not really the essence of what the purpose of our life is. So again, we get lost in the movie and we miss the essence of the purpose of our lives. I hope I can remember this correctly. the great Catholic female mystic, Saint Teresa of Avila, she obviously had this spiritually transformed life, and someone reportedly came to her to ask about her prayers and the impact of her prayers. And, they said to her, what do you say to God? And she says, well, I don't say much. I mainly listen. And the person said, oh, well, what does God say to you? And she says, well, he doesn't say much. He mainly listens. And, you know, at first your tendency, the Western mind, is to say, well, gee, it doesn't sound like there's much going on there, right? Because there's no dialogue. as if dialogue is the solution to all of this. Well, no, it's the listening, it's the communing, it's the being with, it's the being influenced by at a level that is deeper and richer than language. So yeah, we are addicted to language, and the result is our spiritual life tends to be conceptual, and conceptual understandings just are not spiritually transformative.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, as I was reading the article, it got me musing on how verbal we are as Mormons. Our worship services consist of announcements, you know, which are words, hymns, which are words, giving talks, which are words, sitting in gospel doctrine or gospel principles, again, exchanging words. We start with a prayer and end with a closing prayer, which are words. And we really seem to have a difficult time worshiping without words. And so this seems like a very radical concept, to commune with God without words. I think a lot of people probably do think that to commune means to talk to or to talk with. But it sounds like you're talking about a form of communing with God that just doesn't involve language at all. It's not about praying, and it's not about acquisition. It's not about asking him to solve your problems for you, but just being with him. And I guess that brings us back to where meditation comes into play.
Well, absolutely, because language is part of the veil that obstructs our vision of the nature and presence of God and the nature of our own soul. Language is a part of the veil, so it's one of the things that needs to be removed so we can see clearly. I mean, when President McKay talked about two elements, you know, he says in our worship there are two elements: spiritual communion from our meditation and instruction from others. Well, our meetings are obviously all instruction from others. There is no communion in our meetings. If you attended a Quaker service, most of the time in a Quaker service is spent in silence. I mean, that would just completely freak us out.
Yeah, it seems like we give a head nod to the idea of silence in a couple concepts. I mean, the ones that come most readily to mind are during the sacrament, where we are silent, really for the only time during church. Other than that, we're back to the beehive of activity and of speaking. And the other, of course, being in the celestial room in the temple, you know, without divulging anything. Everything else basically involves words. And it's not until, and I think it's interesting that in the, what are the most sacred, most holy places and moments in LDS worship, that silence is there, that with referring again to the sacrament and to the celestial room. But it seems like we maybe have a hard time with silence and don't know what to do with it once we get it.
Exactly. I mean, just watch people in sacrament meeting during the sacrament and see what they're doing. They don't know what to do with the silence. People look around, distract themselves, they play with things. I saw a lady balancing her checkbook one time during the sacrament. We just don't know what to do with silence. I'll go into the celestial room and sit down, and I want to commune. I want to sit in silence. I've been in the celestial room and had groups of people around me talking about their family, talking about their new truck, talking about stuff that's going on in their ward or some party they're having. I mean, they're doing it in the celestial room. I've been in the celestial room. I'll stay in there long enough for everybody to go, where there's maybe only me and one or two other people, and then have temple workers get nervous because I've been in there so long and start, you know, walking by and coughing and trying to move me along. So we're not comfortable with silence. And, you know, we talk about the still small voice, but we're not comfortable listening for it for some reason.
Let's return to this, to the topic of non-attachment. You know, as we all know, Western culture is very acquisitive. It focuses, you know, we live in a culture of consumerism where a lot of our attention is constantly diverted towards trying to get us to feel and think as if we need to acquire various things, and then performing labor to earn the money to acquire those things, with the carrot being dangled in front of us that we will achieve some sort of happiness or contentment or satisfaction in our life with acquiring the latest and greatest whatever. And so this idea of non-attachment it runs very contrary to our Western culture. And I imagine that there's at least some listeners out there who might have the reaction I had the first time I learned about non-attachment, when I really wasn't ready for the concept yet, where I thought that this idea of non-attachment was misguided, in that we do need to be, and indeed ought to be, attached to certain things, that we ought to be attached to the church, that we ought to be attached to our families. As Mormons, we put so much emphasis on having eternal families, and so the idea of being eternally attached to our spouse and seeing sealing as a way of permanently attaching us to each other. And I think a lot of people would say, you know, it's good for me to be attached to my children. And so could you explain, could you respond to that, what may be, you know, a typical Western response to the idea of non-attachment?
Yeah, and this is where we see the problem is, in English we don't have a word to describe this concept of non-attachment very well. So we just kind of struggle with that. But, you know, you've got Jesus saying, he who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And then he follows that with, take up your cross and following me. I mean, that's it would be the hardest attachment to let go, this family attachment. He seems to be asking that. I mean, in Luke 14, what does he say? Whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple. Matthew 5:8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Well, in the Eastern context, purity means non-sticky. It means you're pure because you're not contaminated with something else. There's not attachment or stickiness to other things. And because there is that freedom, then there is a clarity of sight to be able to see God. Typically, as long as we're attached to things, there seems to be an underlying element of need. I'm trying to fill a particular sense of deficiency or need by having a certain relationship, a certain image, a certain position, a certain possession. And that's a game that we never win. And that's what's being addressed with this principle of non-attachment. Now, can it get to an extreme? Well, sure. I mean, if you go to India and wander around, you're going to see some of these naked yogis. These are people who literally have no possessions, no clothes, and they wander around teaching their philosophy and begging for food. I mean, is that what Jesus is requiring or demanding? Well, I don't think so. I think the principle here is, we need to root our identity in God and fully in God. And when our needs and desires are met in God, then the peace and the fullness and the wholeness and the happiness and the satisfaction that comes out of that then enriches in a very pure way our desires, our relationships, the things that we own, the situations that we find ourselves in. Non-attachment really is a way of freeing ourselves to be rooted in God, the love and peace of God, and then anything that's good in our lives. I mean, and I mean good situations, good people, possessions that are necessary to sustain our lives, those things then become avenues for the expression of the nature and the character and the love of God rather than some subconscious need to have those things to feel secure and to feel okay. It adds a... it allows us to fulfill God's purpose in those things rather than to meet our underlying psychological needs.
So this here's another idea, another concept you bring up in your essay is that another common Western response to or criticism of the idea of non-attachment is that their idea of love, they equate love with being attached. That, of course, I need to be attached to my wife. If I love her, love is a good thing. If love is a good thing and love means attachment, then attachment must not be a bad thing. And your response in the article essentially is, yes, but can you truly love someone while being attached to so many things? I was wondering if you could discuss that a bit.
Yeah. See, typically when, I mean, you watch couples, I need you, I want you, I have to have you. But what happens when these couples have conflict? What happens when these couples start fighting? I mean, typically people get together because there's a idea that this person is going to meet my needs in a way that another person can't. And then they get into a marriage and they find that they've married a human being who has their own needs and their own problems and their own difficulties. And at some point, they're not meeting your need the way you anticipated. Well, then resentment pops up and there's anger and then there's conflict and there's frustration. And, you know, where is the love in all of that? I think, you know, when Jesus says, seek ye first the kingdom of God, and that means full awareness and full attention, then all of these other things will be added. Rather than do that, before we seek first the kingdom, we reach out to put together all of these situations, relationships, in the way that we think is best, and then struggle with the complications as they arise. Rather than emptying ourselves of the need and the attachments, rooting our identity, fulfilling our needs and finding wholeness in relationship with God, and then moving into our life, our circumstances and situations and relationships, empowered by this sense of wholeness and fullness, and then being empowered to really be able to love selflessly and fully and completely. As long as I feel that someone's going to withdraw their love from me and I'm going to feel threatened, there's going to be conflict with that person. If I'm whole and complete in God, even if they fail to meet my needs, I don't have to react with defensiveness or hostility or anger or fear. I can reach out and maybe provide nourishment or healing or a sense of God's fullness when they're weak and when they're not able to maybe rise up and do something that's pleasurable or good or satisfying or meaningful for me. I'm not dependent on them to meet a need that only God himself can meet.
Yeah, so that's an interesting idea. I mean, that, and I think what you point out is correct, which is that, yeah, I mean, we get married for the reason that we have certain we feel like we have certain needs and desires and wants and goals, and we're very attached to them. And we see this person that we're bringing into our life as someone who can fulfill those, help fulfill those goals and needs and wants. And of course, the source of so much marital conflict being that because we're so attached to these needs, and because we're so attached to our feeling of entitlement for our spouse to meet those needs, that when our spouse then fails to meet those needs or wants, or fails to help us reach our goals, our attachment to that feeling of entitlement for them to accomplish that for us creates all sorts of anger and resentment. Is that the idea?
Well, yeah, and it's very common in relationships. One minute you're feeling very close, very warm, very nourished, very loving, and then something can happen where there's this bitter anger and conflict. Well, that's not pure love. See, there's something wrong there. There's something going on that's reflecting neediness, and not the fullness and wholeness of experiencing your inner soul nature. As you know, we didn't talk about this, but in yogic philosophy, the belief is that at the core of your being, you are in the image of God, meaning that in your soul is goodness, wholeness, love, joy, peace in a whole and a complete form, that is the nature of your inner being. In much of Christianity, the belief is that the soul is flawed, that it's deficient. And that is the experience of the natural man, that it is flawed and deficient. And so we reach out to attach ourselves to all of these things to compensate for that. Well, it just has, I mean, in all of history, that is not proven to work. So Mormonism is weird because at one level, we teach this divine nature of the Spirit, this infinite divine potential of the Spirit, but yet we practice our religion in such a way, as I've said, where people feel inadequate or deficient. So I think we have a contradiction in what we teach and how we teach it. The result is people not feeling whole and complete, and then people ending up with a whole load of attachments. And all attachments aren't bad. I mean, clearly some people are attached to what we might consider to be sinful things or evil things to compensate for needs in their life. But there is a kind of spiritual materialism where people attach themselves to education or job or success or talent or ability. They're good things. But as long as they're primarily meeting a psychological need that's based in deficiency, it's not going to ultimately be fulfilling. And so that kind of attachment still creates a problem.
Mm-hmm. I want to read a quote here from your article. You say, quote, "In the East, the concept of non-attachment is viewed positively, since it refers to the ability to find happiness beyond the play of pleasure and pain, because it points to a kind of happiness rooted in something deeper than the world of form. Also, practitioners of non-attachment know that being non-attached does not mean that you don't care, don't assume responsibility, nor ignore the needs and feelings of others." And I thought that was an important clarification to make, is that non-attachment doesn't mean, like you said, it doesn't mean taking this attitude of, I don't care about anything, I don't have responsibility over anything, I don't care about your feelings. That non-attachment, really what you're talking about here is selflessness. It's the elimination of self-interest.
That's correct. And the truth is, it is the non-attached person who is empowered and most capable of loving purely and selfishly. I mean, that's the paradox of this. And a paradox is that which seems contradictory but is in fact true.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of a scripture. I believe it's Romans chapter 8, where Paul is explaining, to my knowledge, the word unconditional love doesn't show up in Scripture, although we use that terminology a lot, unconditional love. But I think for me, the closest we get to that is in Romans 8, where Paul says he's differentiating between the love that people, that mankind is able to have, versus the divine love, the love God is able to have, the love Christ is able to have. And he does that by saying, you know, a man will, you know, clings to his life. He doesn't want to sacrifice his life. But he might give up his life to save the life of a very good man. You know, someone might jump in the way and take a bullet for Gandhi or for Mother Teresa. But he says that Christ showed his love to us, and that in that he died for us while we were still sinners. And there it seems to me Paul is again talking about how Christ's sort of love was so full of non-attachment that he didn't condition his love on approval, that he loved us and died for us even while we weren't worthy of it, even while we were still sinners. And do you see that as talking about the concept of non-attachment?
Well, yeah, first of all, he can see through. In other words, he sees the nature of the soul, and he's going to work for the redemption of the soul, regardless of how deeply involved we are in ignorance or not. I mean, I mentioned this in the article. Look at what we do with the parable of the prodigal son. I used to hate that parable. It made no sense to me. It's now one of my favorites. But we do strange things with it in Mormonism. I mean, you have the two sons. The one son leaves the presence of the father, goes out into the world, squanders his inheritance in riotous living, ends up in the pig pen, which of course in Jewish imagery is the bottom of the barrel, you know, pigs being unclean, it's as low as you can go. And you know, in the King James Bible, as he's in that state, the phrase is, he came to himself. Interesting phrase. And then he wants to be back in the presence of the Father. He feels unworthy, so he just wants to be on the corner of the property as a servant. He doesn't expect full admission because he's proven himself unworthy. And so he starts the trek back, hoping just to be on the corner. Well, what happens? The Father sees him coming. I mean, in our typical sense of justice and morality, we would expect that he'd make the kid come all the way back up, drag him in the house, string him up, punish him in some way, and then stick him on the corner of the property. Instead, Jesus uses this story to reveal the true nature of God. The second he sees him, he rushes out to meet him. He slips the shoes on his feet, which is symbolic of family, not servant, puts the robe around him. He puts the ring on his finger. It's complete and full acceptance as a family member. And then he brings him inside for the celebration. The other son, who is described as never having violated any of the commandments of the Father, he's the ultimate commandment keeper, which in Mormonism is the pinnacle of spirituality. He's now standing outside pouting because he didn't get a party. And, you know, you have to say to yourself at this point, you know, whose heart is closest to the Father? Well, you know, we interpret that parable, at least Elder McConkie did, that it's nice the kid, the prodigal, got a party, but when it's all said and done, he's going to be subservient to this impatient, angry, uncompassionate son who kept all the commandments, who's going to inherit all things. I mean, we're so hung up on this attachment to commandment keeping being the end all that we take the clear meaning of this parable and turn it completely inside out. The message there is, and of course the father goes out to try to bring the commandment keeping son in. And of course, if you look at the parable in its context, Jesus is using the elder son to represent the Pharisees, the religious leaders of the day who did all the external stuff right, but didn't do the internal things. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
The prodigal son finally gets the inside right and then ends up being received completely by the father in spite of the ignorance and the sin that he was in. So we get attached to notions of spirituality being a certain way to such a degree that we can take a clear teaching of Jesus where he reveals the true nature of the Father, turn it inside out.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonstories.org. To keep the podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonstories.org. Music for this podcast was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. The Mormon Stories logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening. Still